Succession number 26726, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Mr. Gordon Shermer, a retired engine driver, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Swindon on the 4th of July 2002.
It all started, as far as I'm concerned, when I was 5 years of age, because I remember my fifth birthday very, very, very clearly, because it was on my fifth birthday that my mother had me in a little zinc bath on the table at Havelock Street, because in those days we didn't have a bathroom.
Where were you born?
I was born actually in Old Town, 56 North Street.
In where?
North Street, up in Old Town.
Oh, Old Town, in Swindon.
Yeah, but at 5 years of age, Mum and Dad bought a house in Havelock Street, and that's where we came down, and it was there, my fifth birthday, that, like I say, I was having this bath on the table, and the door opened, and Dad came in with his little red box, and at the time I didn't realise it, but the word on the top of the box was the name Hornby. And he took the lid off this box, and he brought out this model locomotive, and it was of course clockwork, and he wound it up with a key, and he held it up for me to see, and when the wheels had run down and the spring had run down, he put this little toy engine back in the box and put the lid on, and he said, when you've had your bath, that's yours, happy birthday. And that's the quickest bath I've ever had in my life.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1921. And this, of course, was 1926.
Did your father work on the railway?
Yeah, Dad was a boilermaker in the A shop in the works. My grandfather was a boilermaker. My son went in the drawing office, and my sister was in the wages office, and I was the rebel. I declared out and became on the operative side and became a driver. It was the one ambition I ever wanted. I never had any other desire to do anything at all in my life. Somehow I wanted to be a driver. And of course in those days it was very difficult to get on the footplate, because unless your father was a driver or a passenger guard or a shunter or a signalman, someone in the operative side, you had very little chance. Because I remember my dad saying to me, "For getting on the footplate, my boy," he said, "you got about as much chance as a snowflake in a baker's oven." He said, "because I can't do anything for you."
So many kids wanted to do it, is that right?
So many. Well, it wasn't that. It was they were very choosy who they had. And like I say, unless you had relations in the operative side of the railway, you had a job to get there. But I was very determined. And when I left school, I had to go into the works, because Dad had tried to apprentice me as fitter and turner. And, of course, I got this job and went into the Great Western Works in 1936. And that was March the 6th, 1936. And until I became old enough to go out for my apprenticeship, of course, they made me an office boy in the drawing office. Actually, the old print house was attached to the drawing office, and it was in the print house where we used to take prints off of the draftsman's diagrams that went out into the shops for the workmen to work from. And eventually Dad said to me, "Well, I've got your papers," he said, "but they can't give you fitting and turning." He said, "they've offered you a boiler maker like me, coppersmith, tinsmith, or a painter." So he said, "it's up to you what you want to do." I said, "Dad, you know what I want to do." And I said, "I'm going to see Mr. Smith, the chief draftsman, in the drawing office to see if he can help me." And I always remember I went and knocked on his door, and he's come in. Now, he was the head man over the locomotives, drawings, and the carriage and wagons. And he said to me, "What's your problem, young man?" I said, "Well, sir," I said, "my father has just had my apprenticeship papers," I said, "to go into the workshops." "Well, what about it?" he said. "What have they offered you?" And I told him, "Boilermaker, coppersmith, tinsmith." "Very good trades," he said. "What's your problem then?" I said, "I don't want that, sir." I said, "I want to be an engine driver." "What?" he said. "Come over here." And of course, behind his chair was the window that looked down on the Gloucester branch and Swindon running sheds. And this is his actual words. And he was a gruff old man. And he swore and he said, "You see all that bloody dirt and dust down there?" he said. "You'll be down there," he said, "on Christmas Day when you ought to be with your mates. Sundays, he said, when you ought to be in church, down there. He said, at night, when everybody else is in bed, you'll be at work. You don't want a job like that, he said. You go back, he said, and think about those four trades that you've been offered. He said, and when you've made up your mind, you come and see me next Wednesday and tell me what you want to be. So I went home and told Dad, see, and Dad said, there you are. He said, I told you. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to see him again next Wednesday. So next Wednesday, I went and knocked on his office door again, and he said, come in, and I remember looking over his glasses at me, and he said, ah, yes, he said. Young man, he said, well, have you made up your mind what you want to be? And I said, yes, sir. He said, what is it? I said, I want to be an engine driver. And he clenched his fist, and he banged the table, his desk, and he said then, so you bloody shall. And it was Mr. Smith, chief draftsman at Swindon, that got me down to the running sheds on February the 1st, 1937. And that's one day after my 16th birthday. And I always remember, because I reported to the office at 9 o'clock, and the head foreman, Mr. Duck, said, young man, he said, you're an hour late. He said, you're not in the offices now. He said, we work 24 hours a day down here, 365 days a year. He said, not a very good start, he said, for a career. Oh, I said, I'm very sorry, sir. He said, that's all right. But he said, from now on, he said, you'll have different shifts, and you'll be working all kinds of shifts. You'll be working Sundays, and when you're old enough, you'll be working nights. And that's how it started. Now, for 2 years now, I was cleaning locomotives, which I enjoyed very much. I remember the first little shunting engine I ever cleaned was 2060, and the first passenger engine I ever cleaned was Madrasfield Court, 2947.
And that, I mean, what did cleaning it involve?
That cleaned all the boiler and all the wheels and down in the engine pits and all the motion, everything. We could climb up on the boilers, which we had to do the copper around the chimney top and the brass around the safety valves and the number plates and the name plates. Up on top of the cab roof, black and white oil in the cabin. But on no account was we ever allowed on the footplate. The footplate was taboo for engine cleaners. You were never allowed up where the control was. And I remember one day, I was cleaning a 31 class, a big prairie tank, and I remember the chargeman cleaner saying, make a good job of this engine, because tonight it's pulling and taking Bertram Hill Circus from Swindon to Bath. So she's on a special run tonight, make a good job. And I was cleaning this locomotive, and another cleaner went by, and he said, here, he said, there's a funny looking little shunting engine round the little table, little turntable. He said, I think it's a South Wales dock engine, because he said, up in the cab, he said, instead of seats, it's a lot of lockers, and the driver seems to sit on there. And of course, naturally, being interested, I put the waist down and I said, where is it then? And both of my mates, two more, the three of us, walked over to this little engine. The first two, my mates, climbed up into the cab and went across the footplate, up into the corner of the cab. And as I climbed up the cab and looked across the footplate, looking up the other side to me was the head of the head foreman, Mr. Duck. And he beckoned to me with his finger. And I went up one side of the locomotive, crossed the footplate, down the other side, and when I turned round and looked at him, he pointed to the doors and he said, home for the rest of the day. And I was sent home for the rest of the day for being on the footplate. On the footplate for an engine cleaner was strictly forbidden. And that was it.
How much were you paid at that time?
We were paid 20 pence a day, which was 4 shillings. 24 shillings, 24 shillings a week for 6 days. And that was 8 till half past 5 when we were on days, Saturdays 6 in the morning till 12 noon. And for that it was 4 shillings a day, 24 shillings a week. And then, of course, in 1939, with the approaching of the war, I was called into the office one day and the head foreman said, now look, he said, as you know, when you go out on a spare fire intern, we need a fireman, we take a cleaner, and you get paid 9 and 6 a day. I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, you're going to be made a temporary fireman. That means to say, you are not being made a permanent fireman, and you will be called upon to do firing duties when there's a fireman missing or were short of a fireman. When we don't need a fireman, he said, you will return to your cleaning duties. But every time you go firing, you'll be paid 9 and 6 a day. Which I did on many occasions. And then, of course, September the 3rd, 1939, outbreak of war. And I was called into the office again and told that I would have to go to Parkhouse now for my medical examination, as I was about to be made a fireman, which I was. In 1939, October 1939, I was made a permanent fireman. And then, of course, my duties now concerned shunting engines in marshalling yards, and then eventually, through promotion, working up onto freight trains where the work was harder and I went longer distances. And eventually, of course, in 1947, I reached the peak of my career as a fireman, because I was appointed now in the top link at Swindon. And for the next 7 years now, I was with the same driver all the time on the expresses from Swindon through to Leicester, London, down into the West, down into Cardiff. And for those 7 years, I had a wonderful apprenticeship. He was one of the nicest men you could ever, ever work with.
What was his name?
Mr. Hinder. Bill Hinder was his name. And I always remember the first day I went with him. He said, matey, he said, it looks as though you and I are going to be together for a long time, because promotion is rather slow. So he said, it looks as though we're going to be a team for some time. And he said, I would just like to say this to you. I like things right. If a small defect appears on the locomotive, we deal with it before it becomes a large one. And when you are not shoveling, looking out that eyeglass, he said, and you give me the position of a signal, whether it's at caution, whether it's all clear, or whether it's a danger, because it's a signal I can't see owing to the curvature of the line, before you pick up that shovel, he said, and start firing this locomotive again, you look again at that signal to see that what you said to me was correct. And I never, ever forgot those words. I thought it was wonderful. And
Can I just interrupt you a minute? You know, you operated out of Swindon running sheds all the time.
Yes, all the time.
So your working day began at Swindon and finished at Swindon, did it?
Yes, I spent the whole of my career at Swindon. I was lucky enough not to have to go to another depot to get promotion. It just my luck that every time there was a vacancy for a fireman or a driver, it so happened that it just befell me. And I never moved from Swindon. Many of my mates did. Many of my mates went down into South Wales. Some went to London, Old Oak. But I was lucky. Every time there was a vacancy for a fireman or a driver, I was available. And I never had to move at all. So I was very, very lucky. My whole 46 years was done at Swindon. That was a long time, wasn't it?
So if, for instance, take, for example, an express running out of Paddington down to South Wales, Cardiff, for instance.
Yeah.
There would be a driver and fireman change at Swindon on the way, would it?
Sometimes the London men, they had longer runs than us, of course. They would go right through to Cardiff and back sometimes, but then sometimes they would work as far as Swindon, and we would relieve them, and we would go down to Cardiff and back, come back to Swindon, and London men would relieve us again and work it to London. It was different diagram working all the time.
Did you have a limit on the number of hours you worked for?
Well, all jobs was supposed to be never rostered more than 9 hours. The proper rostered day was 8 hours, of course. 6 8-hour days, 48 hours. But sometimes, with the timing of the train, it wasn't possible to do it in 8 hours. But the management was never supposed to ever roster a turn that exceeded 9 hours. And of course, they were very strict about this, and when you booked off duty, you were never allowed to book on again unless you'd had 12 hours rest. They would not book you on duty under 12 hours. If you had a job, we'll say, for instance, you were 6 in the morning, should be finishing at 2, and unfortunately, it was a long day, something happened, you was in a derailment, or somebody else was derailed, and you didn't book off till gone 6 o'clock at night, which was over 12 hours, you wouldn't be allowed to book on again 6 o'clock next morning. You would book on 12 hours after you booked off duty, irrespective of what that was. And of course that was immense during the war, because it was nothing in the wartime to do 24 hours, 27 hours, 36 hours. It was colossal through the war. No food, no rest. It was terrible, the condition.
I want to come on to your war work in due course, but perhaps could you tell me, as a fireman on an express, this is the most dramatic.
Yes.
You had to keep steam pressure up to its 250 pounds or whatever.
Yes, whatever the locomotive was.
How many tons of coal, for instance, would you shovel?
Well,
one station and another.
To London and back, we would shovel about 3.5 ton of coal. But my greatest achievement, and it was an achievement for me, and I'm always proud to be able to talk about it, July 2nd, 1953, was a test run with King Class Locomotive 6001. And the reason for this test run was that they were experiment with improved drafting. They were putting two blast pipes in the smoke box. And the reason for this is they were trying to devise something that would force the heating ingredients out of the coal much quicker. Because we were getting such poor quality coal, German coal, Belgian coal, we was never getting the coal that the locomotives was designed to burn, which was South Wales coal, steam coal. In fact, the Bell Pear firebox on a Great Western locomotive was designed for South Wales coal. And on that particular day, this test run, we travelled to Reading, Bill and I, my driver, regular driver, and we took out of 6001, King Class locomotive, the heaviest and the most powerful on the region. And our train was 25 coaches, 796 ton, which was 300 ton over the load of a King Class locomotive, because a King Class locomotive is 500 tons. This was 796 ton. 25 coaches, and the train was 1/4 mile long. And we pulled out of Reading, and at Goring we went on to test. And the test was now to be 40,000 pounds steaming rate an hour. And I shoveled 3.5 ton of coal in 70 minutes, which you'll find works out roughly about 100 weight a mile. Something like that. Nothing about that. I've never worked so hard in all my life, and I've never heard a locomotive barking so much as it did. But that locomotive, with that terrific load and that terrific weight, we achieved a speed of 84 mile an hour, which was colossal for that weight. And I even had to open the firewall doors to stop steam issuing from the safety valves, because I was getting more steam than I needed. And that locomotive was 30 years old. It was colossal. And the remarkable thing about it, 6001, and she was built in 1927 for £7,546. One nameplate, one of her nameplates, was sold a few months ago for £36,500. That's unbelievable, isn't it? If I'd only known that day, I'd have took hacksaw to work instead of some food in me box. And that was the most strenuous trip I've ever had in my life, you know.
Now, a little while back you said that the fireman had to spot the signals for the driver sometimes.
Yes, yes.
It's always baffled me, because all the GWR locomotives had the driver on the right-hand side of the cab.
Yes.
And many of the signals were on the left-hand side
of
the track.
The Great Western put their signals everywhere, all over the place.
Really?
They're not like the LMS. The LMS were very standard. Wherever it was humanly possible, it was the driver's side.
On the left.
That's right. But the Great Western, they dialed them everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
And it was something that you got to know. I mean, after a certain amount of time, I mean, I knew every signal from Swindon to London, to Cardiff, and to Leicester. Air longest run, that was to Leicester.
And they're all semaphore signals in those days.
All semaphore signals, yeah.
With oil lamps.
With oil lamps. But there was nothing wrong with the oil lamp signal, providing the spectacle plates were clean. Those signals were as clear, crystal clear. And what a lot of people don't realise, that you had your red glass for your stoplight, but your bottom glass on the semaphore was blue.
On a home signal.
On a home signal. Or any signal where you wanted a green light, the glass was blue. And when the blue glass was put in front of the yellow flame, now you got your green light. yellow and blue glass gave you the green light. Now, there's many people don't realise that, and if you down the museum, you'll notice the signals down there. The spectacle plates are blue, red and blue, or amber and blue. If it's a distance signal, of course, it's amber. But a lot of people don't know that. It's one of the questions I was asked when I passed for a driver. What is the colour of the glass? And I said, it's blue.
Yeah.
That's quite right, he said.
Yeah,
it's a fact. A lot of people don't realise that. Definitely.
Now, the other thing, you've told me about the amount of coal you had to shovel and so on. Now, if you did a run down from, say, Swindon to London...
Yeah.
You'd pop into the Paddington running sheds and top up with coal.
Not necessarily. We had a job at Swindon, worked by two sets of men. We would book on at 7:30 in the morning. We would prepare the locomotive. We'd work the 9 o'clock from Swindon up to Paddington, arriving at Paddington at 10:50. They would take the train off of you. The locomotive, we would drift back to what was known as Rangley Bridge, where there was a turntable. And we'd turn the locomotive and then get ourselves ready to come back down with the 1:18 p.m. from Paddington. That was stopping at Reading, Didcot, Challow and Swindon. On arrival at Swindon, we would be relieved by Swindon men, and they would take that train now, 3:18 from Swindon, right through to Weston-super-Mare, stopping at Chipnham, Bath, Bristol, Yatton, Weston. Arriving at Weston at 5:15, and we would turn the locomotive on the turntable at Weston-super-Mare, and we would work the 8:25 stopping train from Weston-super-Mare back to Swindon, and that was 22 stations we stopped at, and we arrived back in Swindon at 11:15 at night. The coaches we'd put in the side in, the locomotive would go to shed, get down the shed roughly about midnight. It would be cold, the fire would be clean, the smoke box would be emptied, the fire would be shoveled right out, the fire would be relit, the engine would be re-oiled again next morning at 7:30, and she would do that all over again.
So a tender full of coal would last you all day?
That's what I'm just going to say.
Yeah.
The tender of a large locomotive, a 4,000-gallon tender, was designed to hold 6 tonne of coal. That was level with the top of the tender. But by piling it up above that, we could get as much as 10 ton on the tender. And what used to happen when we had a large engine preparing it 7:30 in the morning, the fireman would put well over a ton of coal in his firebox preparing the fire. And when he'd done that, before they went off shed, he'd slip under the coal stage and get more coal put on top. And we would go off shed with about 10 ton of coal. But after she'd been through to London, back through to Weston-super-Mare, back to Swindon at night, that tender would be skimmed right out of coal. And if the tender was empty of coal, then the firebox was full of ashes and clinker. And it was an hour's work to clean out a firebox of one of those big locomotives. King-class locomotive, 11 foot 6 long, almost 3 foot 6 wide. And with that full of clinker, was really some job.
So the fire had to die down anyway.
Well, when the driver and fireman brought the engine in the shed, there was still fire in there, but it wasn't died down to where it was almost out. I mean, it was mostly clinker and ashes anyway. But the fire dropper, and I've always considered that the fire dropper on any motive power depot is the hardest job there was on the system, because that was really hard work. Where the beat of the engine had forced the heat ingredients out of the coal and the coal had fused, it wasn't cinders like you get in a fire, it was clinker, like lava out of a volcano. And where that had run through the fire bars, that used to have to be chiseled off with a great big chisel. Now, their shovel for cleaning the firebox on a King-class locomotive, the handle alone was 13 foot 6 long. Because on the end of that, they had the blade of the shovel, and they had to reach right up, 11 foot 6, right up the front of that firebox.
How did all the clinker come out then?
Just
at the bottom?
No, it was shoveled out through the fire hall door.
Really?
Through the door, and that's what used to take the time. And they'd start at the back, they had a system where they wouldn't get the arm of the shovel over the heat. They would clean it right from the back, so that as they dragged it out, there was nothing underneath. That was the secret of it. I mean, if they had started halfway up the middle, well, the handle of the fire iron had been red hot. So they had a system where they started right at the back. Mm. So that as they shoveled forward, there was nothing underneath the arm of the shovel.
I would have thought it would be a bit like a domestic fire grate. You could have a big box that you could pull out.
No, it was impossible. And after they'd finished that, then they used to have to get down in the engine pit underneath the locomotive and rake the ash pan out. Filthy job,
oh,
that was.
Yeah.
All the ashes about, and of course it would all blow over them. And those men, I'm not telling you a word of a lie, those men could pick up red hot coals with their hand. Their hands were like leather. Unbelievable. Was the hardest work there was. Because there was many, many, many jobs on a locomotive depot. I mean, there was the men that coaled the engines. There was the men that cleaned the firebox, a fire dropper. There was the smoke boxer that cleaned the smoke box. There was the lighter up, the man that relit the engines. There was the steam raiser that used to come round and push the fire all over the box and gradually build up the steam for the driver and fireman when they booked on duty. Because when a driver and fireman booked on duty, there always had to be a certain amount of steam on the pressure gauge for him to work from. It was no good to come in with about an hour's time to prepare a locomotive and find that your pressure gauge was right back on the nought. You wouldn't be able to do it in an hour. So there was the lighter up that lit the fire. There was the steam raiser that played about with the fire and got the steam pressure up to a certain pressure for when the driver and fireman booked on duty.
How long would it take from the moment of lighting the fire to getting full steam pressure up?
If the locomotive was dead cold, if she'd been stopped and boiler washed, which she was done every 10 days, or if she'd been stopped for valves and pistons or any mechanical failure and she was stone cold, then it was 8 hours. Mm. To build up from stone cold to a pressure where she could be worked on. But if nothing was wrong with the locomotive, they never ever got cold. They would come in red hot and the fire would be thrown out and the fire would be relit again and she was still hot and still had pressure, still had steam in the boiler. Never at zero when she'd had the fire.
How long would that be then? 2 or 3 hours?
Oh yeah, less than that. Mm. But I mean, she generally spent about 2 or 3 hours. We always assume that a steam locomotive works 16 hours out of 24. That was if two sets of men, 8 hours each, and then 8 hours in the shed being prepared for her next turn of duty. But that is the difference with the diesel locomotive, because where a steam engine would spend 8 hours in the shed every 10 days after have the boiler washed out, a diesel locomotive, if there's nothing wrong with her mechanically or electrically, when she comes into the depot and the fitters and that swarm over, she was okay, she'd take on 800 gallons of fuel, 1200 gallons of water, and she'd go straight back out the depot and start work again. A diesel locomotive would work 23 hours out of 24. She would pull passenger trains in the daytime. She would pull freight trains at night. One man, not two, one man, and pull three times what a steam engine would pull. King-class locomotive, the most powerful engine we had, 500 tons was her load. Diesel will pull 1,500, quite easy. So it was economically to change from steam traction to diesel.
So how many miles in a day would a diesel cover then?
Well, that all depends on what run she's on. Yeah. But I can tell you today that the high-speed train, the 125-mile-an-hour trains, they do well over 1,000 miles a day. Yeah. Yes, they do. And they have got their bases, but their diagram work takes them into different depots certain days. For instance, London, a high-speed train at London would go off and work perhaps from Paddington through to Swansea back to Paddington, then Paddington now back to Cardiff, finish in the shed and be serviced. The next day she would come out and she would go back to Paddington, Paddington now perhaps down to the west of England, end up at Penzance, serviced at Penzance. And it was perhaps every third day they would arrive back at their home depot. But they were served at all these other depots. That was their diagram work. And of course the secret of any train that does that amount of mileage a day is good maintenance. That is the secret of the high speed train, is good maintenance. And when you consider the difference with speeds, I mean the high-speed train today, 125 mile, it takes just 28 seconds to travel a mile. Whereas years ago, 80 miles an hour, you had time to look and look again. And although the physical effort is gone from the front of the train, the stress at the front end of a train today is tremendous. Mm. And the secret of the train driver today, of course, is concentration. Very, very severe concentration. No hard work, I mean it's plush seats, foot warmers, armrests, ashtrays, everything. But all that at 125 miles an hour is apt to lull you into a sense of weightlessness. It's so continuous. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but I have been told that the Japanese, with their bullet train, their bullet nose, that runs from Osaka through to Tokyo, a distance of 320 mile, they've taught their drivers that as they go by the signal, they must point to it. Every time they go by, they point, and that brings in a little physical effort. And they claim that helps with the stress. Whether they do it when there's no one up there, I don't know. But it's quite feasible.
Why did it take so long for the diesels to replace steam?
Well, of course, you've got to remember that all the drivers had to go back to school. And it was a tremendous task to teach all the men that had been used to steam engines this new type of traction.